Campus FM presents the first in a series of lectures by Professor Freda Steuer, expert in terminology and technical translation. The lecture was organized by the Department of Maltese at the University of Malta and is entitled Conceptual and Terminological Programs in Technical Translation.
Nilqakom għal din is-serje ta' taħdidiet, tliet taħdidiet li se tagħmlilna il-professoressa Dr. Frida Sters mill-Belġju. Kif nafu il-lingwa Maltija bħala lingwa ta' poplu maħkum qatt ma kellha l-opportunità li tiżviluppa f'tant oqsma mixtieqa. Għal ħafna u ħafna sekli kienet il-lingwa mitkellma biss u mitkellma biss 50 toqsma bażiċi tal-ħajja. L-oqsma l-oħra, l-oqsma importanti, iktar importanti soċjalment, uffiċjalment, kienu meħudin dejjem il-lingwa barranija. U għalhekk mhux ħaġeb illi l-Malti ma żviluppax it-terminoloġija tiegħu fl-oqsma differenti. Ġi mument imma fl-istorja tagħna meta l-Malti sar il-sin nazzjonali u allura kellu jidħol għal tant oqsma ġodda biex ikun verament jiffunzjona bħala l-sin nazzjonali. Oqsma bħal-liġijiet, bħal il-lingwa tal-Knisja u tant oqsma oħra. Meta konna għadna qegħdin biex ngħidlek nitħabtu biex nilħqu dak il-livell fejn il-Malti jsir verament nazzjonali, fis-sens li jkun daħal fl-oqsma differenti ta' importanza nazzjonali, u meta forsi għadna lanqas li konna ngħidu ilħaqna dak il-livell verament, ġiet fuqna mewġa oħra, il-mewġa tal-Malti bħala l-sien uffiċjali tal-Unjoni Ewropea. Fejn allura mill-Malti ġi mitlub illi mhux biss jesprimi il-ħajja Maltija, imma anke jesprimi tant oqsma ta' ħajja Ewropea illi uħud minnhom lanqas biss fil-fatt jolqtu lill-poplu Malti direttament. Per eżempju jeżistu tradutturi fil-Brussell jew fil-Lussemburgu li qegħdin jittraduċu dokumenti bħal per eżempju terminoloġija tat-tren sewa, meta it-tren fil-fatt nafu li mhijiex parti mill-esperjenza diretta tal-Maltin. Għalhekk din hija sfida kbira, sfida li ħadetilna nifisna, ħallietna bla nifs. U m'għandniex nistaġbu għaliex kif għedna il-sin żgħir u l-passi li kellu jagħmel kienu passi kbar, jiena nħobb inċebħu ma' tifel li rid ilaħħaq ma' missieru adult li għaddej passi ta' ġgant. Jekk il-lingwi l-oħra iktar preparati tħabtu qed jitħabtu kemm iktar irid jitħabat il-Malti. F'din il-moment ta' sfida ta' prova daħlu diversi organizzazzjonijiet biex jagħtu daqatit. Jiena nixtieq insemmi il-korsijiet ta' traduzzjoni u tal-interpretazzjoni li qed isiru fl-università, il-Kunsill Nazzjonali tal-Insien Malti, illi għandu propju kumitat minnhom illi jaħdem fuq it-terminoloġija u t-traduzzjoni, u id-Dipartiment tal-Malti mill-parti tiegħu jipprova jagħmel il-sem tiegħu wkoll. U għalhekk illi fil-fatt il-lejla qegħdin nistiednu fostna lill-professoressa Sters. Hawnhekk qed inġibu l-aħjar tal-aħjar fil-veru sens. Għaliex il-professoressa Sters jitkellem għalhekk ma nitkellimx jiena, jitkellem il-kurrikulum vitae kbir u importanti li għandha. Ngħid biss illi hija il-president tal-Kummissjoni Co-Term, il-Kummissjoni Uffiċjali għat-Terminoloġija tal-Unjoni Olandiża tal-Lingwa, hija wkoll il-kap tad-Dipartiment tat-Traduzzjoni u l-Interpretazzjoni fil-Lessius Hoge School ta' Antwerp fil-Belġju. Kienet inkarigata minn bosta programmi ta' riċerka dwar dizzjonarji elettroniċi, l-użu tal-multimedja fl-iskejjel u anke dwar databases terminoloġiċi. Mexxiet ħafna seminars pajjiżi differenti u għalhekk illum u għall-pjaċir tagħna li noffrulkom dawn it-taħdidiet. Il-professoressa Sters se titkellem ma' nixxi ngħidu bl-Ingliż, però kull min jishti jistaqsi domanda jekk ma jridx jitkellem bl-Ingliż jista' jgħidha bil-Malti u aħna nittraduċula. Wara s-sessjoni, din is-sessjoni qiegħda tkun reġistrata wkoll rekordjata u bit-tama li tibqa' online imbagħad fil-radju tal-università, fil-campus, u li nitlobkom huwa li l-mistoqsijiet għal dan ir-raġuni jsiru fl-aħħar. Wara madwar sija, il-professor issa se tħallilna l-ħin biex nistaqsu l-mistoqsijiet. Nirringrazzjakom ħafna, nirringrazzja ħafna l-kull min ta' semu, il-sħabi tal-dipartiment, il-nies tal-Kunsill Nazzjonali tal-Isim Malti, u b'mod speċjali l-Olvin Vella li verament huwa l-bniedem li tħabat ħafna anke biex fl-affarijiet loġistiċi li waslu għal-lejla. Nirringrazzjakom. Professoressa Frida Sters.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, it is a very big pleasure for me to be here and to have been invited by the organizers of these conferences. For me, it's my first visit to Malta. For the last 2 days, I have been able to have a look around in your wonderful country. And I've also had the opportunity to talk to some of your colleagues and to find out a little bit about your language and about the particular situation you're in dealing with a national language and with the membership of the European Union. Allow me to explain something about my own background first so that you might understand better why, for me, terminology and multilingualism is so important. You already heard that Dr. Mifsud said, I come from Belgium. I live in Antwerp in the northern part, and perhaps you know that in Belgium we have 3 official languages. The northern part speaks Dutch, also called Flemish, but there is only 1 Dutch official language. The southern part speaks French, and as you are aware, Brussels is a bilingual town, Dutch and French speaking, and we have a very small part speaking German. So 3 official languages. This alone makes it very important in our country to understand communities and to start translating and to start having a proper way of dealing with terminology and vocabulary. But the Dutch language is also spoken in the Netherlands, the country just to the north of Belgium, together with the Netherlands. So Flanders combined with the Netherlands, we are 21 million speakers of Dutch. That's why the governments of the Netherlands and Flanders decided to join their efforts together for everything dealing with language. Because you might say Dutch is a small language in the sense, well, we can't compete with English or French or German, if you look at the number of people speaking the language, but Dutch is a smaller language, 21 million speakers. On the other hand, we're a strong economic unit, and we consider our language to be important. So we decided to join efforts, and both ministries of education and the ministries of culture of the Netherlands and Belgium, so 4 ministries combined, they give all the money to the united project of the Taalunie, the Dutch Language Union, it is called. In other words, if we create dictionaries, if we do something about terminology, about language awareness raising abroad, it's all done by one and the same office. This makes us strong, in a sense, and it identifies us to the other countries. We'll talk about the organizational structure of the Taalunie tomorrow in another lecture, because it might bring you also some ideas as to how you could organize in your own country some of these commissions and organizations. But let me stress first of all that for me, the richness of Europe is its history and its multilingual aspects. Every nation, every people has a right to speak his or her own language. Yeah? And in Europe, this is unique. we might evolve towards a kind of United States of Europe, but not in the sense that we will all speak the same language. Your own language is very important for the identity of yourself, your people, and your historic background. And this is a unique opportunity in Europe because multilingualism is written in the Constitution. All the official languages are equal. We might say it costs an enormous amount of money to keep this up and to keep translation going and to keep interpreting going, but still they calculated the actual cost of translation for all 20 languages still is one cup of coffee for each inhabitant of the European Union per year. So it's not that much. But I think we should really try to preserve this principle of multilinguality and all languages being equal. Now, this imposes a high challenge on governments, on translation services, on companies, but it is really important. Although we have to agree that English and French may be working languages on the floor, otherwise I couldn't be here if there was no go-between. For me, this is not my native tongue. I speak Dutch and French at home, and English is my third language. But if there was no go-between, then there could not be any communication right now. So still, this is important. But again, the multilingual program of the European Commission is extremely, extremely valuable. And we should have a look at how to realize this, in fact, by joining efforts, and we will see that terminology is a very important aspect of this problem. So I was asked to deliver three lectures. My first lecture today will be on, let's say, an introduction into terminography and terminology management. I'll talk about 1 hour, and then we can have questions and discussion time. And then tomorrow I'll be talking about standardization and language planning, so how official standards will help us to communicate and to organize a language in an official way. And the third lecture will be on conceptual and terminological problems in translation. Then we'll focus on translation more specifically. Okay? Coming from Belgium, I can assure you that the struggle to keep your own language alive and kicking was for the Flemish part very important. Up to 1930, we did not have our own university in our own native tongue. Everything had to be in French. So we have struggled so long to have our official Dutch Flemish language in the educational system and everywhere that we don't want to lose it now in a competition against other larger languages such as English or other languages. So that's why, from my personal background, it is also very important to have this multilingual aspect of languages. But let's have a look at how, in fact, terminology behaves in language. What is terminology and what is vocabulary? The words we use in everyday language, that's our general vocabulary. The vocabulary you use, let's say, in home, garden, and kitchen use, that's your normal and regular vocabulary. This is also the set of words that is compiled by the normal and regular dictionaries. Yeah? And we call this the language for general purpose. Okay? So this is the general vocabulary. And mind my words, I use the word vocabulary and the word words. In the general dictionary, you find the general vocabulary and you find the words of a language. Of course, the set of words, the set of vocabulary is changing from year to year. In Belgium, we have Vandalen as the reference dictionary for Dutch, as you have Webster for English or Cobild, and the way you have other important dictionaries for other languages, such as Le Robert for French. And each 3 years, you get a new edition because there is an ongoing shift of vocabulary and new words pop up into everyday life. That's a normal evolution. We don't speak the same language that was spoken 40 years ago or 50 years ago because new items come into our life and we need new words for that. Now, there is also, in contrast with the language for general purpose, there is a language for special purpose, LSP, and this is, let's say, the technical and professional communication. Yeah? So there is always this relation between the specialized terminology of a particular subdomain, let's say telecommunication, computing, medical subdomains, where the technicians or the specialists use their specialized terminology, and the general vocabulary. Now, we might wonder, where do these terms come from? How are they created? Well, of course, there is a mutual shift and borrowing from general vocabulary into specialized vocabulary and vice versa. One example, words dealing with, or terms, specialized terms dealing with computers or with portable phones used to be very technical in the beginning when the technology had been launched. It was only used by the specialists, the experts. Gradually, the use of the computer, the use of a portable phone, was there for everyone. And now we can consider it home, garden, and kitchen words, basically. Words we're using every day. So there is this constant mutual change and borrowing. In some cases, we borrow a very general word and make it into a more technical term for a particular subdomain. And in some cases, it's the other way around. A very technical term becomes a more general word. So there is a constant evolution and a constant shift here in the terminology and also a shift in the use of the terms. So we should be aware of this. Definitely, translators and people writing documents, technical documents, also have to be aware of which term am I going to choose, how am I going to create a new term, for example. Let's have a look at some of the productive mechanisms in terminology, in word formation. For example, there are a number of what we call productive splinters. This is a property of the morphology of a language. Think about Watergate. You all know what Watergate was originally. It was the name of a building. It was a proper name. Yeah? But because of the fact that a political scandal was discovered in a Watergate building, the political scandal on its own was identified as Watergate. And this was continued in the newspapers. Everybody was talking about Watergate, Watergate scandal, and so on and so on, in all languages, basically. Later on, there was another political scandal when there were some illegal weapons sold to Iran, and the journalists created a new term, a neologism, and they said Irangate. Gate had nothing to do with a specific suffix that had a meaning. It was created in analogy to Watergate. And then you had Irangate, you had Pasquagate. This was a scandal with the French Prime Minister Charles Pasqua, and so on. So it continued to be productive, although basically it's nonsense. I mean, the term itself doesn't mean anything. So this is one way journalists and newspapers, very often terms come into existence through newspapers or advertising. Because these people are the most creative ones. They have to write about new phenomena and they have to create new terminology. Other examples are contractions between breakfast and lunch. You get brunch. This is also a system in language to become productive. Or a hotel, we knew the term hotel. Then motel was created, a motorway hotel. And then an airtel is a hotel that is close to an airport, and so on and so on. So you can start being productive and creating in such a way. Also, changes in meaning do occur. For example, the word terminal, very general word, means it's a terminating point somewhere. You can find it in a general dictionary. But then it was used in computing, and it became more special. A terminal is a computer that is at the end of the connection and that is linked to the mainframe or to any other central server. So in other words, the general idea of terminal is then made more specific in the field of computing. Very difficult questions for each language society, for each translator, for each person writing texts is, what kind of choices am I going to make? Am I going to opt for a translation of a particular term? Could be a literal translation, word to word, let's say. Am I going to opt for a kind of equivalence I can think of, analogy? Or am I going to coin a completely new term? And very often, this can be successful. Sometimes a very crazy word comes up, or a term comes up, and it is successful. It is accepted by the language community, and from then on, it will start leading its own life. But in some cases, the suggestion made is unsuccessful, and people are not happy with the term. It doesn't get accepted in the language community, and it is forgotten after some time. A couple of interesting examples that I took from experiences of my own in translation, from English into Dutch and into Afrikaans. Why do I bring Afrikaans in here? You know that Afrikaans is the language spoken in South Africa, a language derived from Dutch. For us, it is very strange to hear someone speaking Afrikaans, because it is as if our language stopped in 1700 and developed into some other direction. Yeah? So they have double negation, they have some very strange pronunciations, but it is fun and we can understand each other, but it is like if the language took a different road, but the basic vocabulary, the basic structure is the same. Interesting comparison here is, of course, I don't have to explain this, English is a dominant language in most technical subdomains. Most new terminology, new developments, new texts, new scientific developments will first be introduced in English, coming into international journals, official magazines, and very often we will have to translate or react against this English term. An example in Dutch. Dutch is a Germanic language, is in between English and German. So for us, it is not very difficult to accept an English term in our own language. It sounds good. It follows the morphological rules. There is nothing shocking about it, basically. So what happened when the term computer came into being in English? In Dutch, we simply accepted the term computer. Yeah? But this was not done in South Africa. They absolutely wanted to create their own term in Afrikaans, and they created rekenaar. Now, the word to compute means to calculate. It's nothing else. If you look up the word to compute in a general dictionary, it's simply a calculator, to calculate. So the Afrikaans people, what they did was, they simply translated literally. They said, okay, to calculate, rekenen. Perfect. It works perfect in South Africa. In our country, we didn't think of this, and we accepted the English term. I just want to make clear that a language community has a choice and can make choices. The same for milkshake. You all know the drink, a milkshake. Literally, the milk is shaken with some ice cream or some flavors. Again, in Dutch, we accepted the word milkshake, although it's not obvious, because I remember my grandparents look at this word, and shake is a sound. It doesn't exist in Dutch. So for them, this was very weird, because that generation didn't know any English at all, so it was not obvious to accept it. In Afrikaans, they decided to have a literal translation. Milk is melk, shake is schommelen, to shake. Okay, so melkschommel. Why not? Another interesting difference is in lexicography between the Netherlands and Flanders. Although the Dutch we speak is the same official language, so in some cases, the people in the Netherlands prefer another term as to what we prefer. So you can find both in the dictionary then, but with a regional difference. For example, in electronic payment, in banking, we pay with a pay card. Yeah? Well, there is a personal identification number on your banking card. This is the PIN code in English, personal identification number. In the Netherlands, they copied the term PIN, which is perfect in Dutch, and they made it into a productive verb. Bin, binnen, binde, gepin. So you can conjugate it as a normal, regular verb. So I know if I translate for the market in the Netherlands, I have to use the word binnen. And in a text on banking, I will have to use this word. If I do this in Flanders, in Belgium, no one will understand me, and there I will need the term elektronisch betalen, to pay electronically. I can't explain why one is accepted in one society and not in the other, but that's the case. The same with the chip, you know, the chip on a bank card that in fact collects some money on the chip itself. This is called Proton in Flanders. It's a proper name for your electronic wallet, for the money that's on the chip. And in the Netherlands, it is again the English term that prevailed, and they say chippen. From the English, they make a productive, Dutch, morphologically correct term. And the same with email. Email is kept as email in Dutch, but we can also have e-post, from the term post, literal translation. Whereas in French, they had an excellent finding there. They said courriel, from le courrier, and courriel is then le courrier électronique. They joined both items, courrier, electronique became courriel. Thank you. And then a last example. For English, we have the term Walkman. In Dutch, we kept Walkman for this particular item as a musical instrument. But the French, of course, absolutely had to have a translation, because in France, an English term is absolutely out of the question. They want to translate everything and create a term almost manu militare. They want to enforce the term, even though the public might not like it. And they then enforce baladeur. Why baladeur? Se balader is a verb meaning to walk. So they made, in fact, a translation from to walk into balader, baladeur. The most ridiculous example, however, I ever came across in technical translation is the one about flat cable in computing. If you're working in the subdomain of computing, you can have a cable from one computing device to another. It's a flat cable, literally, with different wires in the cable, and it feeds one part of a computer to another. In Dutch, in every technical document, you will find the word flat cable. Now, this is an interesting example of borrowing of an English term, which in Dutch is very specific. When I read flat cable in a Dutch document, I immediately know this is computing terminology. It can't be anything else. Whereas, to be honest, flat cable in English is very broad, could be anything. The French, again, couldn't accept it. They were thinking about the French equivalent. And then they thought, well, since this cable gives food, feeds from one part to the other, we'll take cordon ombilical, which is basically the medical term for the food given from the mother to the unborn baby. So it is something taken from a completely different context, and it is quite ridiculous if an engineer has to use this term in a computing text, of course. So we'll have to see how these things, yes or no, get accepted. A short example from Dutch. I won't go into detail here, but here we have English terms in computing. ICT is information and communication technology. So that's the broad word for computing as a subdomain. Terms such as to retrieve, benchmark, bubble memory, and workstation are very technical terms in computing. We were analyzing some Dutch documents on computing, and this is what we found. For the very technical concept to retrieve data in a computer, we found at least 6 different translations. You don't have to know Dutch to understand the problem immediately. 6 translations, all of them are good. all these verbs are okay. It is just unwanted, unpleasant, and very disturbing to have six translations for the same concept, because then people get lost. What are we talking about? Although they're all good translations, they're not synonyms. So again, this causes a problem. The same for benchmark. We found at least six or five different items in Dutch. All were good findings by translators, but the question is, what is the real correct translation here? So that's a problem that occurs everywhere. Okay, again, it is not only a problem of translation. We did some research at our institute. Some of our students analyzed British and American car manuals. So the manual you get when you buy a car. So this is English as the original source language. No translation. But two of the brands were British car brands, two were American. Now, you can say, yes, but American English is not the same. There are some structural differences with British English. That's true. But these differences also occurred, the inconsistencies we found in the manuals also occurred within one and the same manual. So in one and the same British manual or in one and the same American manual. For example, there was a constant confusion between lamp and light. But lamp and light is not the same. The concepts are not identical. You can say the lamp is the item, is the instrument, and light is the product. You shouldn't just interchange this in one paragraph. These mistakes have to do with the lack of a concept system behind the whole concept of the car manual. They just start writing, and then they start confusing concepts and terms. For example, a very common mistake is the mixture of air conditioning system and climate control in one and the same paragraph. But this is not identical. You could wonder, what is it in reality? Well, a climate control system in a car is much broader than the actual air conditioning. Climate control can also include other items in the car. Catalytic converter and emission control system. Catalytic converter is part of an emission control system, but it is not identical. And again, it was used in one and the same paragraph. Fuel economy, fuel consumption were always mixed up. And also, some cars seem to use a sunroof, and others use a moonroof for the open roof. Very strange, this type of confusion. In a Dutch manual from a Japanese car constructor, we found very, very many inconsistencies. What happened is that, first of all, the Japanese car constructors, because we did some research on that as well, the Japanese car constructors don't understand the European market. They don't understand that we have 20 languages, and they think that, well, you know, translation is something very unimportant and is done in a rather automatic way. First of all, they already create their own English manual. We looked at the manual and we said, this is not English. We called it Jap-English. It's some kind of Japanese English, but it's not English. So first of all, we had to convince them to have it retranslated into an English version for the British market, an English version for the Irish market, because obviously they have different regulations and different safety and security systems. So this is called localization within the translation process. And we would have liked a third English version for the European market. Because if somebody buys this car in Paris, but the person doesn't understand French and wants to have the manual in English, he needs a manual for the continental market, but this won't be identical to the British or the Irish market. So this is already very complex. And then we looked at a Dutch manual that had been translated and used over and over again. And finally, we saw that a very simple concept in the car called traction control had been translated in 6 different ways. For each of these, TCLC steam and so on and so on, we could say, this is good. I mean, the translator did a good job. Unfortunately, the 6 variations occurred in 1 and the same manual. So this is, of course, very unfortunate and very confusing for the person reading the manual. So we should try and avoid this type of problem. So in fact, when looking at these examples, what I can say is terminological confusion is unwanted, and it will cost companies an enormous amount of money. Unfortunately, it is also unavoidable. Language is alive. People are creative. Different translators will work on different texts and come up with different ideas. So it is very difficult to get terminology standards really into practice. But at least this is something we should consider and we should think about. We would be happy, looking at our experience in companies and looking at different fields, if only in one and the same company there would be a consistent terminology. That would be marvelous. We have some very good examples, like BMW. They did create a very, very good terminology support system, and they try and strive to have a unique terminology for BMW used everywhere in their documents. So that is a success on its own. Although we're not that far that we can say that that terminology can also be used by Mercedes or another car brand, still it's a big success, and that's what we call in-house terminology. If at least one company or one particular unit can be consistent in the use of terminology, and therefore it needs awareness raising about the problem. Now, when we talk about terms, because now gradually we will shift into the real terminology database. When we talk about terms, first of all, we have to make sure that we really know what a term is. Term is a specialized designation, and it designates a clearly definable, concrete, or abstract object. Yeah? So it can be an idea, but it has to define an object or a concept. So first we'll have to think about what are we talking about here, and is this unique or not? Let's try and define the concept. That's why you have this little triangle. I'm afraid that you can't read it properly. I should change colors here. So at the top of the triangle is the term. On the left-hand side, in the left corner, is object. And at the right-hand side is the word concept. Yeah? So in other words, if you have a particular object, let's take this object here, then first I have to define it. I have to name it, make it unique. Yeah? That is the conceptual description of this unique object. And then I can assign it a term. The term here could be laptop, for example. So that's the relation. You have to identify an object or an idea in real life. You have to write down, what is this concept about? How can I identify this? Basically, you write down a kind of definition then. And then you can name it. And this is very important to realize that this triangle in terminology is very important. So, how can we define then a concept? Well, a concept will be written down as a kind of definition where you use the more or less specific characteristics of that particular object. Yeah? So, if you have to make a definition of this laptop, then you can start by saying it is a personal computer that can be used in a portable way or something like that. Yeah? So you give a general idea as to in what category it belongs and then its main characteristics. That is very important. In other words, the definition and the delimitation of that concept, also the determination, so to define it very precisely, can only be done when you look at the concept in the whole system of that particular subdomain. I'll give you a very concrete example about this. So this is called semantic networking, or defining the subdomain. Imagine you have to write a text about printers. And if you want to, or translate a text about printing devices, and if you want to use the correct terminology for a translator, it will be very important to at least have a vague idea as to how many types of printers there are. So although a translator or a text writer doesn't have to be the expert, he's not the expert who designs printing tools, but a very basic knowledge about the semantic network and the conceptual structure is important. For example, if a translator knows that on the one hand there is a category of laser printers, and on the other hand there is a category of inkjet printers, and thirdly, there is a group of matrix printers, the old-fashioned printers with the needles. Yeah? Then at least you have the overview of the semantic network or the concept system. If then a new term comes up in printing, you can see, well, where does it belong? Are we talking about a laser jet printer, or another type of printer? Is it a pure inkjet printer, or is this a needle printer? And only then, if you know this structure, this semantic network or concept structure, you can design the right term. It's also very tricky to start translating about green energy, about, for example, windmills and things like that, if you don't have any clue as to how green energy is organized, how many types are there. So the basic concept structure is very important. Such a conceptual system can be organized in different ways. You can look at logical relations. You can also you can classify, for example, the group of horses according to their color. But you can also classify horses according to their breed, Arabian, Holstein, and others. You can classify in different ways. You can make an ontological system work, where you say, well, if this is a car engine, then these are the big parts. Let's have a look at these parts, and then we know where a particular term will belong. Okay? So you have different choices in the structure. That's one thing you have to take into account. In which subdomain am I working, and how is this domain organized? So a basic idea about the subdomain is really necessary before you can do the work, before you can start translating or working in that domain. A second problem is the level of language used. We call it the register. If you have to translate a text from English, it is not enough to know the subdomain you're writing about and the basic idea of conceptual structure, but you also have to define the level and the type of communicator. In other words, two questions. For what type of audience was the source text written? Yeah? Was this a very technical communication, or was it more vulgar, more general? And the second question, which not necessarily has the same answer as the first one, is for what kind of audience am I writing my translation? It can be that a very highly technical text has to be translated one register lower, or it can be on the same level. So, basically, the field of use and the communicators have to be identified. I've written a couple of examples. On a very high technical and specific level, this can be from scientist to scientist. In other words, think about a medical text. In a medical text, from scientist to scientist, there is no need to start vulgarizing every item. You can use the Latin scientific names and you can stick to that. Or in telecommunication, you can stick to some English, very high technical procedures. Don't bother to translate them. In some cases, this will be your choice. But when you're dealing with scientific and technical staff communicating to skilled workers, then it might be very useful to give alternatives in the own language. Okay, so this is also a question to consider. So what is terminography, in fact? Terminography is the way we write down the terms. the way we register terms in a kind of database. 20 or 30 years ago, this was simply done on cardboard papers, and it was stored in a big cardboard box. That was it. That was terminology work. Every translator had a list or a file of cards with terms written on it. Nowadays, we create this in an electronic way using a terminology database. In other words, you can consider this to be a kind of specialized dictionary. But we collect it in a very interesting way. The database is very multifunctional because you can, in fact, question the database in all different ways. It's very useful. And it's very easy to update the data once you started a database, of course. First, an example. Here is an example in multi-term. Multi-term is a format used to collect linguistic data. How many people have already worked in multi-term here? Or no, some of you, okay. So multi-term is just a brand name. It is a linguistic database created by Trados. You can compare it to an Access database or any other type of database system. The only difference is it was pre-programmed especially for linguistic use. And the advantage is that in the gray level at the top, you can shift the target and the source languages by one click on the button. Imagine you create your database for English, French, German, and Maltese language. Then you can say, now I want Maltese to be my source language. You get all the terminology in Maltese, and you get a translation into the other languages. With one shift from the button, you can make English your source and Maltese your target, or the other way around. So this is very flexible. In the left-hand column, you can then see the list of terms you already recorded in the database, and in the left corner at the bottom, you can see the subdomain you're working in. And then you get the actual record. This is something about, I think it's about medical. No, this is about church ornaments. And here the database is created in German, in Latin, and in Italian. Anyhow, you can see the German part at the top and then the Latin part underneath and then the English and then the Italian. In each case, you get information with definition, contexts, remarks, and so on. And it's quite interesting to compare these different items. I included another one about a medical field, dermatology, in English and Dutch. And there you can see that acne neonatorum, that's the item in English and in Dutch, is in fact the Latin scientific term that is used. And then you can have the vulgar terms listed in the database. Everything that is green on the screen here are hyperlinks. So these are related terms. If you click on the term, another record will open and you will see other related information. So this is also a way to have an electronic walk through your database and to make it more feasible. Okay, we won't go into the last example. Just a brief overview. What are the main differences between a traditional dictionary, let's say the lexical items of a normal vocabulary, and a terminology list? Because you might say, yes, but when we do create a general dictionary, we can also create a specialized dictionary. So now what's the difference? Well, in the lexical items, of course, we look at the headword that is multiple and polysemic. It has many meanings, and they can be listed just one after the other. Look for an item in Webster or Cobuild. You will see many, many different meanings attached to it, and these are listed just one after the other. You find some grammatical information that's quite important in the normal lexicography. There is a strict alphabetical order. It describes how the term or how the word is used, with lots of examples. It limits itself to the general language, the everyday language, and it gives you all the words related to. So adjectives, let's say even the past participle will be included, and conjugation of a verb and so on. Whereas in the terminological list, the concept, it is driven by the concept. So first we look at the general concept, and then we prefer to have one concept, one term. Only limited grammatical information is given, but the structure is first and foremost logical and not necessarily alphabetical in order. It tries to prescribe good usage. In other words, if there are different terms that we can come up with, we try to put the recommended term in the entry, and then terms that are less recommended or less advisable, we'll put them apart and we'll say, well, yes, but this is old-fashioned, or this is not used, and so on and so on. So it works with a sub-language, and mainly, let's say, 80 or 85% of the database will contain nouns and nominal structures. Less verbs, less adjectives are included here. Okay. So now what happens when we start creating such a database? Well, don't forget, it's a linguistic database. We talk about language and including linguistic data. Before you start creating your own terminology database, it's important to find out what is going to be your input. In other words, in how many languages do you want to work? What are your data? One subdomain, you're only working in telecommunications, or are you going to work for several subdomains? So how is your input going to be? And what is the output you would like to get out of it? And that's quite important. In other words, how would you like your database to look like afterwards, and how would you like to consult it? Is the consultation only for yourself, as a translator or an expert? Or is this for a larger audience? Do you have pedagogical ideas? Do you want to train and teach people using your database? Whatever. Another important question will be, what is the hardware I'm going to use? Is this strictly PC-based? Am I going to create my database on a standalone PC and not share the data with someone else? Or is this a network version and are different translators going to work together or different people in a group? Or am I going to share my data over the internet? You can create a multi-term version over the internet where different people can combine their work. You have to think about the structure, the actual record structure, exchangeability of data with other people, and how to consult it. Do you want people to be able to consult it over the internet or not? Or is this strictly personal? Sometimes a database is even, well, almost carefully controlled and no one else can see it. It can be a big secret for a company to have such a database. Another thing we have to be aware of is that it is an investment. It does cost time and money to start terminology work. It's not obvious. The best thing to do is to start by a pilot project, let's say a preliminary, where you try to create part of a database, see how does it go, how does it work, and to see whether you have enough IT support. Is there a computer specialist ready to help you with your database? What if you get stuck? Afterwards, you can try and see, is it worth continuing my project, and can we then update it, work on it together, and refine it? But definitely for a company or for a particular service, it will cost money, it will cost time, it's an investment to start such a project. Okay? It's also important to see if you create a database for a larger service, let's say a government service or a company, then you might want some feedback from the users. Imagine you are the terminologist in a company. You create a database and you allow all the people in the company to use it. Then feedback is extremely valuable because some of the users might tell you, yes, but there is another term that you didn't include, or you made a mistake here and there is a translation that is much better, and so on and so on. So you have to consider, how are you going to organize feedback? Are you going to have a mailbox system where users can post their remarks? For example, in the largest terminology database for the European Commission, that is Eurodicoton, this is done. There is an email virtual window where users can mail their comments, and this is taken care of by senior terminologists. And then they come up with new input for the database. So again, input, it's an important question. What is feasible? Are you going to deal with all types of texts? Are you just dealing with one type of subdomain? And again, the target has to be considered. What kind of database do we want to deliver? That's the output. I already talked about that. And the distribution, the carriers. How do we consult such a database? How are we going to exchange our data? All these are technical questions that have to be considered from the beginning. Another thing is, how rich or how poor is your database going to be? You can have a very rich structure with lots and lots of information, but again, it will be difficult to update this. Or you can make it stricter, more limited, with more material. Will your database be focused on translation? Is that the most important item, how to translate from one language to the other? Or do you prefer a concept-oriented database where it is more the monolingual structure of one language and the structure of the domain that is most important? Also, that is an important question to be considered. Okay? Two models come up. First, there is the monolingual model, because terminology was created by some engineers. They were not at all interested in translation. They wanted to have a clear, let's say, a clear view of how is a subdomain, such as car engineering, how is it organized? So how does a car engine look like, and do I have a correct name or a term for every part? And this was done strictly in one language, and that was German at the time, because the ideas came from Vienna, from the Vienna school, like Eugen Wooster. Fine, if you want a monolingual database, you can do that. You can do a database in Maltese for one subdomain or in English for one subdomain. And then you simply have the term. You have to make a reference to the subdomain. Is it about computing? Is it about medical field or whatever? You need some grammatical information about the term, some lexical information as to, do you have any synonyms? Do you have any spelling variation? You need semantic information, that is a definition. The meaning of the term has to be added. And perhaps some administrative information, that is, who created this record and when the date, when was it created or updated. That's enough for a monolingual database. So you can do that in Maltese or in any other language. But, of course, you can also create a multilingual database, and this is done more often than not, because more often than not, we want to use this for the purpose of translation. So we can start from English into Maltese, or you can have English, French, German, and Maltese, whatever. And then we have a difficult question to face. Do we want a full record for every language? Because this is very time-consuming. It's very interesting to have it, but again, it will be very expensive to update this for all languages. So that means you will have your term in English with definitions and contexts, then the French with definitions and contexts, then the Maltese, and so on and so on. Very often, people will choose for the complete information only in one language, for example, in English, with a definition in English, and then translation in different other languages. But that makes it a bit more manageable, let's say. Or you can opt for the full record in Maltese, with a full definition in Maltese, and then translation in other languages. This is, of course, restricted in use, but it can be more than enough for the actual need, the actual usage. Okay? So that's the most important. I think it's already past 8. Before starting the discussion of the different fields, which might lead us too far for today, I would like to ask if there are any questions so far.
Thinking about the relationship between journalists and linguists. Mm-hmm. What shall be the relationship? Because actually we are thinking about a common technical terminology, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, who does the language itself?
Yeah.
That is the problem we have to face, first of all. So what is your experience from this?
Well, on the one hand, journalists are there, let's say, in the first spot immediately, because they come across all kinds of new trends. They write articles about brand new ideas, and very often through advertising or newspaper articles, this is the first time something is written about a new phenomenon. What we do in standardizing terminology is we include, in the commission dealing with terms, we do include journalists as well. We include teachers, people writing books about these items, journalists and technical people. And then you get the best results when you try to combine these efforts. But very often, the journalist is always first to create a term, and that can't be avoided. Afterwards can be seen whether the term is a success or not. But language is not an artificial process. You can't say to the people, shut up, this concept doesn't exist until we have created a term for it. It simply grows naturally. So that's something you can't avoid. There is still plenty of material, but I think it's a bit too much for one evening.
When you were talking about the register, if I understood correctly, you said that the translator has to take account of the source register and also the target register. I found that rather strange, because I would have thought that the translator has to be careful to maintain exactly the same register. Could you expand a bit on that point, please?
This is not always true. You could say a translator has to make a literal translation, but again, a translator is writing for a particular audience, and it is not necessarily the same type of audience as the one that was meant in the source text. So when we ask for translations in our institute, we will always tell our students, translate this text for that type of audience. Could be, for example, the Netherlands or Flanders, could already mean a small difference. But it could be a sales representative, could be a group of, let's say, nurses or a group of medical doctors. Might be possible that there is some shift in vocabulary or terminology needed. And that is the reality. Translation, on the one hand, you could say, is a process of trying to be as equivalent as possible in the relation between source and target, but you always also need to take into account the assignment you've got, the task you've got, and the target audience. So this also means, in some cases, localizing your text or adapting your text. That's the reality of the translation job.
One case of localization that I can recall is when Professor Sturz actually asked for a beamer for her presentations, and I was going around and asking for a beamer over here with our technicians, but they normally refer to it by a trade name, the InFocus, which is a very common trade name, but people wouldn't refer to it as beamer.
Okay.
Which is probably...
That would then be a mistake in translation for the Maltese market, yeah? Then I would have to use InFocus, yeah? Then I will continue just by pointing out the structure of the database, okay? I think we can conclude that item for today. So if we look at the entry field, then we'll have to discuss which term are we going to include? Which parts of speech are we going to include? Nouns, in some cases also compounds. Compounds occur very often in terminology. Only very rarely we do have verbs or adjectives. So this is the first question. An interesting point here is that we do have a lot of multi-word items, to include, such as sewing machine, front-wheel drive vehicle, and other more complex compounds. We also have to sometimes include head terms that are less specific because we'd like the more specific terms to be clarified. I'll give you an example about relation between abdominal breathing and abdomen. For example, in a database on speech therapy, we wanted to include the term abdominal breathing. It's a breathing technique where you breathe through your abdomen. It's very important for speech therapists to know this technique. But in order for the database to clarify some of the terms, we decided to include abdomen as well. Although abdomen is not a term from speech therapy, it is simply a general anatomic term. But in some cases, we may clarify specific terminology, such as abdominal breathing, using a more general term attached to it. The same with air conditioning and climate control, or lamp and light. If you include them both, you can clarify the relation between them in the record structure. If you make a database about telecommunication, you can create a record for the mobile phone, but in the record you can compare it to other types of phone, and then you can create a structure in that. The conceptual system is very important, of course, in the structure of your database, and it is very much preferred to use superordinate and subordinate terms. So to say, well, for example, this type of inkjet printer belongs to this super category and belongs there and there in the total structure. We did some research for Ricoh, which is a photocopying and faxing company, and they asked our students to compare their manuals and to have a kind of structure of all the terminology made for photocopying machines and faxes. And we came up with some inconsistencies in their manuals, and it even led to new insights for themselves, like, oh God, we use two or three terms in different machines, but they basically they refer to the same conceptual item. For example, each photocopier, each fax machine has a sheet feeder, has a tray for paper, and once you systematize this, you get the right terminology in the right place. We also include fixed expressions and phraseological units. Sometimes these are very difficult to translate, and it's very useful to include them in a terminology database. And then another question we have to ask ourselves is, what about abbreviations? In technical vocabulary, very often abbreviations are used. So you can choose how to deal with these, and very often, if the abbreviation is used more often than the full term, then the abbreviation is put in the entry field. Then it comes first in the database. And then the full form comes later. For example, you have NATO. NATO can be in the entry. And then in the synonym, it says North Atlantic Treaty Organization. There you get a full form. The advantage of the database is if you type NATO, the search will lead you to the correct record, but also if you type North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the full form, it will also guide you to the correct record. And we use the standard dictionary entry. No plurals, no conjugated forms, the pure canonical form. Okay, it's very useful also to start classifying and ordering the entries in advance and to think, how many subdomains am I going to distinguish? How am I going to list these? Is some part of my information more general, like in telecommunication, organizational terminology about the telecom business? Is something more specific, a subdomain about portable phones, another one? You first think about the classification before you start the work. A clear structure is ideal, but it is not always that easy to keep up. A systematic classification code is very useful if you can handle it. UDC, probably most of you know UDC, the Universal Decimal Code. That's the code used in all the library systems where the books are classified. You can use Lenov or ICS. These are different classification models. But we'll come back to that tomorrow in another lecture. Standards. If you can find the right standards from your Standards Institute or from the International Standards Institute, it is useful to refer to these, but it is not always possible. Sometimes there is no standard available. And you can even add a graphical representation in the database. Multiterm and some other systems, they allow for you to enter a picture or a diagram that clarifies the item you're talking about. Then we have grammatical information. Of course, it is not obligatory to include grammatical information, but if you have a language with gender and with lots of inflections, then it's easier to include it immediately. We usually keep the Latin short forms for these references. So M, F, and N for the Latin reference to masculine, feminine, and neuter. The noun, the verb, transitive, verb, intransitive, adjective, adverb. We use, let's say, standard terms, and we don't translate it for every language separately. Otherwise, it gets confusing. And then for lexical information, this can be extremely useful. You can have orthographic variation. For example, in French, you have the buffer memory is called mémoire tampon, but also mémoire à tampon. We consider this to be a small difference in writing, nothing really very important, so this will be considered a variant in writing. Synonyms have to be registered. Even if I started my lecture by saying we don't want any inconsistencies in the terminology, the truth is there are different synonyms that do exist, and it's better to list them and to indicate whether they are really totally unwanted or not used anymore or a bit old-fashioned, but it's better to list them in the database so that people can also see that these terms do exist. Then in some subdomains, such as the medical field, you can compare popular versus scientific information. For example, rubella, the scientific term, versus German measles. Both can be included. And also very useful is geographical information. Like this term is only used in Belgium, but not in the Netherlands, or vice versa. This term is only used in the German spoken in Switzerland, but not in Germany. Things like that can be included in geographical information. But also, in your own terminology database, you have the freedom to include information about your clients. Imagine you do a lot of translation work for IBM, and this is a typical term used by IBM. That's the translation IBM requires. Then you can add that type of information. If you translate for another computer supplier, it's very well possible that they will request another type of translation. So that's up to your own freedom. Abbreviations, I already explained. And then we have the semantic information. We have definitions and we have contexts. The definition, in fact, is the most important part of the database, because there you're going to position the term as clearly as possible. Short and to the point, no negative definitions, no circular reasonings, simply the main characteristics. If possible, 3 or 4 lines, and that's it. So not half a page, not a full page of information. We don't write an encyclopedia. Just 3 lines with the main characteristics, that's enough. So if that's too difficult, you can also use a functional description and just say, well, this iFocus, or what is the name, yes? Sorry? AFocus is used only to make a projection, and that's it. Then you have a functional description. It can be enough. And then clarifying and adding information to the definition can be done using a context. Contexts give you more information, but a context has to be original language material. There you show how the term is used in context. Can be associative, explicative, or even defining, giving an example, giving a clarification. Yeah? So this can also be very useful. How can we find this type of information in a database? We can do that using term extraction tools. Imagine you have a large corpus of texts on computing. And these are digital. You have them on your computer. You have a whole manual or you have different texts. Then you can use tools such as ExtraTerm or other software that allows you to, in fact, analyze the text completely, and possible term candidates will pop out. So the computer tries to isolate the terms. Of course, it's not without mistakes, but at least it's a first selection that is made. And then you can see, well, this is a term I would like to use in my database. This is a term. No, this, forget about it. It's not correct. You leave it out. But when you have the term, you immediately get the context that surrounds it in the actual text. And that is very useful to help you to create your database a bit faster and to speed up the analysis of the material. You can do that for one language, or you can do it bilingual for two languages at the same time, if you have the material, of course. You need texts to do that. Also very useful is when you can use an ontology system that can help you to structure your concepts in a way that is very useful. This may look a bit strange, but these days, due to the internet, basically what Google does, what all these search engines do, is they have a kind of ontology browser. They look at all the different data available and they try to make links according to a semantic network. If you can use that, then you can also build your own knowledge management system starting from a terminology database. Yeah, and then finally, looking at the point of documentation, it can be very interesting to add a field where you can list documents relevant in the service where people can find additional information about texts related to that particular type of terminology. This was done, for example, by Eurocontrol, the large organization dealing with the European aerospace environment. They tried to create a terminology database and then link it to all the different texts available in their library. So this is an extremely useful application. Conclusion for today is that term creation, and in fact the creativity of language, is extremely important for a language to keep up with professional communication. If there is no creativity in your language, if you don't create terms, then basically your language dies. We call it domain dynamics. In Scandinavian languages, especially in Swedish, it already is the case that they think English is so important that they stopped producing texts in Swedish for particular subdomains. They write everything in English. Finally, the language dies for this particular subdomain because no new terminology comes up. That's what we call domain dynamics. As long as your language is alive and is able to deal with new concepts, this is a very important point, I think. So that's what I wanted to say about neologisms and creating your own terminology. And terminography is the art of creating a database in such a way that you can use it either as a monolingual inventory of elements or a multilingual set of data useful for translation and language comparison. But you have to be very careful and consider before starting the creation of a database what you really want to do, what your output is going to be and what your purpose is going to be. I think we can conclude it here for today, because otherwise everybody will run away too tired and won't have anything about the information here. Okay, thank you.
Ringrazio Hafna il professoressa Sters.
You have just listened to the first in a series of lectures by Professor Freda Steuer, expert in terminology and technical translation. The lecture was organized by the Department of Maltese at the University of Malta and is entitled Conceptual and Terminological Programs in Technical Translation.